Welcome to Worldview from WBEZ. I'm Jerome McDonnell. Hurricane Dorian's near miss of Puerto Rico was a relief. The reactions of Puerto Ricans was interesting. In a story on Vice, a 21-year-old retail worker said, "We're making community plans. We're not waiting for anyone to help us after the storm hits. We've already seen how that works. No one comes." We're going to talk about what we've learned about relief situations with Rob Moore, director of the Water and Climate Team with the Natural Resources Defense Council. Good to see you again, Rob.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Jerome.
That person reacting in Puerto Rico, it seems like that's the natural reaction you would have.
Yeah, I think people that have been exposed to traumatic situations, which Hurricane Maria certainly was 2 years ago, I think it could be actually a kind of a positive way to react. Like, you know, we need to strengthen our own community ties. It's an incomplete solution. It's necessary. It's essential that that happen. But locally led solutions and strengthening community are one of the most important factors for people and communities to make it through something like that.
There are some lessons to be learned about ways that we've done this before, and everyone has been kicking around what happened after Hurricane Maria and how well or poorly the United States reacted to that. How do you draw the lessons here? I mean, what kind of things do we need to tick off and remember as we move forward with other disaster relief situations?
Yeah, I think one of the big things that came out of Hurricane Maria is, first off, just looking at kind of government capacity, FEMA actually published a very enlightening after-action report last year looking back at the 2017 disaster season, which included Hurricanes Harvey, Hurricane Irma, and Hurricane Maria, as well as Hurricane Nate. Everybody forgets about Nate. Poor Nate. As well as the California wildfire season in 2017. FEMA plans to be able to respond to what they call two level one disasters simultaneously in any given year. And that was a year where they were actually responding to five level one disasters, each of which by their planning doctrine requires the deployment of 6,000 FEMA staff to each location. Well, they don't have that many people. They can do two. They can't do five. And part of that doctrine at FEMA is driven by our past experience. It is exceedingly rare that two such events would occur in any given year. And that is no longer a safe assumption. You know, climate change has made it far more likely that we will see multiple events occur in a given year and that some locations in the United States may experience a traumatic, catastrophic level event multiple years in a row. And we've seen that in very large number of places in the United States.
Yeah, I mean, Puerto Rico is not the only example. The hurricane's moving on to Florida. And
this will be the third
hurricane
to hit Florida in 3 years after going multiple years without a major hurricane encountering Florida at all. So, yeah, Florida had Hurricane Irma in 2017, Hurricane Michael in 2018, and now Hurricane Doria is making its way for landfall on Labor Day. California, similarly, major wildfire season in 2017, major wildfire season last year, all setting records that you do not want to see set. Houston, Texas is another good example. I mean, in that town, Hurricane Harvey is an event of historic proportions. But for people that live there, they also experienced 500-year flood events in 2016 and 2015. Harvey was just the latest catastrophe. And I could go on and on. North Carolina, Hurricane Matthew in 2016, Hurricane Florence in 2018. I mean, it used to be there'd be years between such events. So recovery could take place at a pace that was helpful. And now,
government, you cannot allocate for everything.
It's exceedingly difficult.
And right now, we've seen the Trump administration, they diverted quite a bit of FEMA money recently to immigration issues. And this was emergency relief money. So they're really in a pickle.
Yeah, FEMA has found itself understaffed this year already, and now Yeah, the president has decided to swipe $155 million from the Disaster Relief Fund. This is the fund that's specifically set aside by Congress to provide assistance in the aftermath of a natural disaster. And now, right at the beginning of hurricane season, we are diverting funds towards crises of our president's own making, in my opinion. But
yeah, it's almost like a psychological game, though. The disaster isn't a sure thing. So it seems like, well, we could take some money from there and get away with it because there's so many other things in the budget that are sure things. And this one seems like it's not a sure thing. But as we've been talking about, it is a sure thing. These things are happening repeatedly.
It's increasingly a sure thing. And that's why Congress, I believe in 8 of the last 10 years, has had to make special appropriations for disasters above and beyond what FEMA is able to provide through the Disaster Relief Fund. So it's becoming an all too regular practice to do these special appropriations. What that means is that we are not planning ahead and recognizing that we are at much greater risk of these events occurring, number one. So we need to account for that in our policies. We need to account for that in our budgeting, government budgeting. And communities need to account for that in the decisions they make about where to build, what to build, and how to build. You know, are we building something in a place that is exposed to a disaster that's entirely foreseeable based on what we know today? Those are all things that contribute to a storm becoming a disaster. It's the decisions we make that turn it into a disaster, unfortunately.
I'm talking with Rob Moore, director of the Water and Climate Team with the Natural Resources Defense Council, and talking about disaster preparedness. Well, if we do really start taking those things into consideration, does that make all coastal areas off limits? You wouldn't build in a really coastal place where there is weather. It seems like that is everywhere.
Well, I think to continue building in areas that we can foresee are vulnerable and more vulnerable by the day to events like sea level rise is certainly folly. We do have to grapple with the fact that we've already built a considerable amount of infrastructure, housing. A lot of our population lives in coastal areas already. So we are going to grapple in the future with how do we address that situation? Are we going to build a seawall that goes from Brownsville, Texas to the northern tip of Maine? Highly unlikely. Are we going to build seawalls in certain places? Yes. I think it's safe to assume we will do something like that around Manhattan. We will probably do something like that around Washington, D.C. or something similar. But we're not going to do it everywhere. So what are we going to do in those other places? That's why there's going to be a lot of choices to make about where are we going to defend and where are we going to decide to help people move towards something different. And that might mean moving away from the coastlines. And that's just for sea level rise. If you look at some of the disasters that have befallen the U.S. in the last couple of years, Harvey's a great example, actually. Florence last year in North Carolina, also a great example. The damage was not really focused along our coastlines. You know, we typically think of hurricanes causing damage from storm surge and high winds. And most of the damage occurred from torrential rains that fell miles and miles and miles inland, far from the coastline. So these extreme events are affecting inland areas as much as they are coastal areas. And flooding in the Midwest this year is a perfect example. I mean, there are areas of the Midwest that have been at flood stage for going on 6 months now, if not more.
Wow. And okay. It seemed like the Midwest wasn't ready for that.
Well, there are certain parts of the Midwest that have been challenged for sure, as anybody would. Each state, takes a different approach to how it prepares for these types of disasters and the policies that guide its decisions for developing in the floodplain. And in Illinois, which has its rivers have been at flood stage as long or almost as long as a state like, say, Missouri this year, you've seen far less damage in Illinois than you've seen in Missouri.
Why is that?
Part of that is because the state of Illinois takes a much more proactive role in how it manages its floodplains. It's done a lot to encourage communities to adopt stronger building codes, where maybe Missouri has not. It has a lot of states that are voluntarily enrolled in a program where they are rewarded with lower flood insurance costs for taking steps like having better building inspections, having better building codes, having better zoning ordinances, having more protective standards in place for construction. That Missouri has far fewer communities that participate in that. If you look in Illinois, another statistic I like to cite, we have a lot fewer properties that have been built in the floodplains since we started mapping them than Missouri does. They allow apparently a lot more development to take place in areas that we have a reasonably good knowledge that are quite vulnerable to flooding. So, you know, that's kind of a you can see just in that comparison, one state has far fewer vulnerabilities than another.
Is there somebody you consider the gold standard of preparedness?
You know, it's I think it's hard to assign that because there are so many variables involved in what preparedness is. I think there are great examples of things that states are doing across the board. Illinois, I think, would be a good inland state to look at for what it's doing on floodplain management. You could look at a state like North Carolina, which earns a lot of chuckles because of its position on its legislature making it illegal, and I'll put air quotes around that, to talk about sea level rise. Yet that state's emergency management agency has compiled more data and makes decisions based on that data than really any other state. They have detailed information that enables them to do high-resolution wildfire risk evaluations, flood evaluations. They have detailed information, much more detailed information on even elevation data that allows them to project flood risk. So they actually have a wealth of information that other states have not invested in. So there's things that different states do very well, and there's things that different states do very poorly.
What do you think is advisable for policymakers these days? I mean, obviously they've got to do a lot. They've got to have a lot more foresight, and they've got to have a vision that is long term. And it seems like policymakers have such a hard time with long term vision. It is a political animal to have. Short-term vision is your next thing.
Yeah, it's difficult to get policymakers to think beyond their next electoral cycle. That's a ongoing problem in so many areas of public policy, but it's particularly acute in disaster policy and what I would call climate adaptation or climate resilience policy. We know that our future looks very different than our past. And we have got to do things very differently in order to prepare for that. So how do you overcome this tendency for short-term thinking when the long-term is really important right now?
And it's so interesting that there's groups like Extinction Rebellion and the Children who are protesting, and they're demanding a long-term kind of attitude.
Absolutely.
Towards a crisis.
They should. They are going to be the adults – literally the adults in the room that get handed this problem in 20 to 30 years. At one degree warming as a result of climate change, we are seeing with all too much clarity exactly how the world is responding. 1.5 degrees, which is the very ambitious goal of the Paris Accords, does not look better than 1 degree. And 2 degrees looks even more scary, much less anything beyond that. So how do we start to get ahead of these problems? Well, one of the first things we need to do is recognize the situation we're in and start planning and budgeting accordingly. The United States spends far more on responding to disasters than it does on preparing for disasters and avoiding disasters. You know, we spend very little, relatively speaking, on how do we help people and communities plan for and develop in ways that puts them less at risk. That is starting to change a little bit. HUD just this week finally announced that it's making $6.8 billion available to, I believe, 9 states and 5 local jurisdictions. That's specifically for disaster mitigation and climate resilience, one of the biggest investments the U.S. government's ever made in that particular arena. That's great. However, we spent $120 billion on disaster recovery in 2017 alone.
Yeah.
And most of that money is going to rebuild in the same vulnerable places and replicate vulnerabilities that were just exposed. So we need to get ahead of that. We need to recognize the benefit of making things safer before they get knocked down. Then we need to also arm people with better information. It's shocking as someone who works predominantly in the arenas of flood risk and sea level rise, how we deny people basic information about the risks they face. In 21 states in the U.S., a buyer or a renter of property is not allowed to know that property's flood history. You're not allowed to know.
That's crazy.
If your home that you're getting ready to purchase has flooded before. 9 other states have what NRDC would rate as inadequate levels of disclosure, where it's exceedingly difficult to learn anything or much of anything. You combine that with the fact that FEMA's flood maps are often years, if not decades, out of date. And even when they are up to date, they say nothing about future flood risk. I like to joke, they don't believe in climate change because they don't say anything about future sea level rise. They don't say anything about the potential for future extreme weather events. They're based entirely on historical experience and historical data.
Wow.
So those aren't a very good source of information. And FEMA itself is prohibited by its interpretation of certain laws like the Privacy Act from giving people information that it has about flood risk. So if you're a homeowner and you don't currently buy insurance, flood insurance from FEMA, you might think to yourself, you know what I should do? I should call FEMA and ask if this house has ever flooded because they know. Because if anybody had flood insurance, they paid a claim out. So they'll tell me. They surely want me to know that. Well, FEMA will tell you we can't tell you that. We're barred from giving you that information until you purchase flood insurance. Then we'll tell you the whole sordid history of your
Thanks
home.
Thanks a lot.
And often people don't get that information until after they file their first damage claim, which is not a really useful time to find out your home has a long, illustrious history of flooding that predates your ownership of the property. So these are all things that just, you know, we give people bad information and then act surprised that they make bad decisions as a result. So these are all correctable problems though. And in fact, I'm very pleased that there's a lot of bipartisan support in Congress for fixing some of those things that I just mentioned, including disclosure and better information from FEMA. So those are some of the low-hanging fruit that we should be able to resolve, I hope.
Rob Moore is director of the Water and Climate Team with the Natural Resources Defense Council. We'll keep our eye on what's happening with disasters and keep up the good work.
Thanks a lot. Thanks again for having me on the show, Jerome.
Coming up after the break, we'll discuss the importance of getting Sudan off the U.S.'s state sponsor of terrorism list. I'm Jerome McDonnell, and you're listening to Worldview on WBEZ. This is Worldview on WBEZ. I'm Jerome McDonnell. Sudan's new prime minister is mulling over cabinet choices and the long list of things he'll have to accomplish to get the country back on its feet again. Prime Minister Abdallah Hamdok is a respected economist and former UN official. His transition government is a huge achievement for the protest movement that started last December and overthrew Sudan's longtime ruler, Omar al-Bashir. Let's talk about the immediate challenges Hamdok faces in Sudan. With me is Amal Hassan Fadlala. She's an associate professor of anthropology at the University of Michigan and author of a book on Sudan called Branding Humanity, Competing Narratives of Rights, Violence, and Global Citizenship. Good to talk with you again, Amal.
Thank you for having me, Jerome.
One of the things that Sudan has to do has to do with the U.S. The need to borrow money is out there, and Sudan would have to get off the state sponsor of terrorism list in the United States to do that. And that is a pretty fishy thing to do. Is that a doable accomplishment?
Yes. I mean, the prime minister, of course, is facing a lot of challenges. He is definitely inheriting a difficult situation here, including, collapsing economy, including, having Sudan in the terror list, including, a huge debt to international lenders, huge inflation rates. So, it's definitely, a difficult situation, but coming with the experiences that he has, there is hope that he can have like a good BR, he can have, a good recovery program in the short run.
It's so far the United States hasn't exactly said it would take Sudan off the state sponsor of terrorism list. The U.S. has played a constructive role. They've said a lot of good things about what's happening, but so far I haven't seen anything about that.
Yes, I mean, has been on the table for a long time. I mean, Bashir regime was sanctioned. Bashir was also, was wanted by the ICC. So the stick of, lifting Sudan from the list of terrorist countries is still there. And what I hear is that if they don't see clear path to democracy and transformation, that will not happen. So it's still there on the table.
You mentioned the gigantic economic problem that Sudan has with debt, and there's like $50 billion in debt. It's more than 60% of gross domestic product, and debt relief is something that is a hard thing to negotiate. The new prime minister is a well-placed person to negotiate it, but that's got to happen in a hurry to get things moving in the economy again.
Yes, I mean, one of the things that people are talking about is the international community also going to chip in and help in this process? Because without, some debt relief, it will be like a really hard thing to do for the prime minister. I mean, he's not, of course, painting a rosy picture about this. He knows the challenges, but he has a lot of hope that, he can negotiate some deals and he can also, gear the economy towards, production more than consumption and kind of revive the agricultural sector and kind of do some work on the public sector. I mean, it needs a lot of work, but people are, they're having a lot of hope about it.
One of the things that I was reading was about the defense budget in Sudan, and it is half of all government spending, and the new prime minister says he wants to cut that. Obviously, the military is still in power and won't be crazy about deep cuts to the military budget, but is that something that's just got to happen?
Exactly. I mean, the whole issue with Bashir regime is like how it invested in security and left everything else like, at the margin. So because the way that Bashir dealt with Sudan's problems and the problem with his opponents is through war. So now, you know, with this transition, people are saying without peace, there is no resolving of economic issues. So they are going to, you know, reserve the first 6 months to peace negotiation. And actually, yesterday I also read that, you know, there are talks now with the armed movements so that they can bring them to this democratic transition.
And when we talk about wars in Sudan, we're talking about Darfur, South Kordofan, and Blue Nile. There's three.
Yes, yes. And when we talk about that, we also have to remember that, you know, these movements are not unified among themselves. So the Darfur movement, you know, broke into different factions. The Sudan Liberation Movement that was fighting the South Sudan, for South Sudan, was also split now. So there is the Blue Nile faction, there is the Nuba Mountain faction, and of course the other went with the South.
One of the things that's interesting about the military that brings the mind into focus is that the two main foreign exchange earners in Sudan have been troop deployments in Yemen in support of Saudi Arabia's effort in Yemen. And the other one is gold exports, which is something the military is highly involved in. And there's a lot of accusations of corruption in this area. Changing that equation sounds pretty treacherous for a new government.
It is. And the marriage between the civilian faction and the military faction is also something new to Sudan. So people are saying, you know, is this going to hold on for a long time? And especially now, there is also investigation that have to be done. So we will see lots of tensions. We will see lots of, attempt to correct things. But would it really, serve the end of this transformation or not? I think the future will tell.
And the accountability aspect you're referring to is probably really high in the minds of a lot of Sudanese when the government, the military was shooting people in the streets. That's something that the protesters want accountability for. And they say, when they're saying things like the military is, you know, addicted to shooting people in the streets, they want to end that addiction. They want to see some kind of thing happen where military people get prosecuted. And the guy who signed the deal for the transition government would seem to be the first in line.
Yeah, and I don't know. I mean, it's really a very kind of, as you're saying, a very difficult route to take. That's why a lot of protesters actually were not happy about this marriage between the civilian and the military, and they were willing to just, you know, continue to revolt until they have, like, a civilian government. But I think at the end, given the history of Sudan and the history of the military in Sudan, this was the best deal to, arrive at, because, they say, well, you know, maybe they can figure some stuff out within this transitional period. So we'll see. I mean, frankly, it's a challenge, but we'll see if the civilian can civilize the military, or who knows.
Is there something outside people and countries can do to help? It seems like there's a lot on the table there.
Yes, I mean, as I said, I mean, people are very, I mean, they think this is a fragile coalition, but a lot of people also think it is going to hold on because the protesters are keeping an eye on the revolution. There is, regional and international actors who are invested in this and interested in it. And I think it might be a success for them to kind of support this process. All of these are possible. Even the Gulf states are now coming and saying, you know, they would support this transitional period.
And they're traditional supporters of the military.
Yes, yes. So I think the military, people are saying Sudan is going through a very tough transition. There is still war. There is still peace negotiation, and having security and having the military is key. So this is their argument. I think, you know, if the our movements, if the leaders did not accept to join the negotiation, there will be a problem.
Is there any key thing that you think regional actors should be on the lookout for? Is there a sign of danger or problems that would pop up here?
Well, I think people are worried about, situations of, any kind of chaotic situation. But it seems to me now with this, with the formation of the Supreme Council, and now the Prime Minister is supposed to announce the Cabinet of Minister anytime, it seems to me that there is hope that there is going to be stability. And if, the international actors and regional actors can stick to their plan that they will support this, this process, there will be no fear. But again, what I sense from the street, again, is a lot of mistrust, a lot of anxiety. And I think it's normal and healthy, but I don't see any kind of, signs of, disillusion of this or, fragmentation of this alliance.
Amal Hassan Fadlala is an associate professor of anthropology at the University of Michigan. She's author of a book on Sudan called Branding Humanity, Competing Narratives of Rights, Violence, and Global Citizenship. And we were talking about some of the challenges facing the new prime minister in Sudan, Abdallah Hamdok, a respected economist who is now head of the transition government in Sudan. Thanks a lot for joining us.
It's great to speak to you. Thank you so much.
Coming up after the break, we will dip into our deep worldview archives and we will hear a 2005 interview about the social impact of Walmart in the United States. I'm Jerome McDonnell. You're listening to Worldview on WBEZ. This is Worldview on WBEZ. I'm Jerome McDonnell. 2019 marks 25 years that Worldviews brought you human stories from at home and abroad. We wanted to bring you some selections from our deep archive. Back in 2005, there were about 80 radio stations in the Chicago market. A study of Chicago radio listeners found that the ones who tune into this radio station, WBEZ, are the least likely to shop at Walmart. 51% of WBEZ listeners in 2005 said that they'd shopped at Walmart. We wondered if that's good for America, so I decided to talk with labor historian Nelson Lichtenstein from the University of California, Santa Barbara. I began by asking how Walmart dictates social policy.
There's a vacuum of what would have been federal policy. That is, take the minimum wage, for example. Minimum wage hasn't been raised for, I think, now we're pushing 7 years. So there's virtually no place in the country that actually pays a minimum wage. It's officially $5.15 an hour in many states, most states. And the minimum wage is in real terms now at its lowest level in 40 years. So in absence of that, the largest employer in an area really sets the minimum wage, and Walmart does that. It's the entry-level wage for Walmart employees, which is depends on the area, but it's somewhere between $7 and $8 an hour.
So they're doing a lot better than minimum wage.
Well, no, but here's the thing. The minimum wage doesn't exist anymore. The minimum wage is sort of kaput. If the minimum wage were at the same relative level as it had been in either 1968 or even 1978, it would be somewhere around $8 an hour, or even actually $9 an hour if it were at what its apogee was in the late 1960s. So in the absence of that, Walmart is establishing the real minimum wage. So I think this is also true, by the way, of health benefits. When a company like Walmart establishes a health benefit standard, then its competitors, not just the retail trade, but in all the sort of the service sector industry. They said, well, look, if we want to compete, then we have to meet that standard. So there's this general erosion in health care benefits, certainly in the service sector.
And to be more specific about Walmart's health care benefits, a little less than half have some kind of health care benefits offered them?
Right. Well, Walmart, of course, offers it to everybody, but it's very difficult for someone to actually find it sort of economically rational to take it. First of all, if you're part-time, and there's still 30% of the workers are part-time, you have to wait 2 years before you qualify. So most part-time workers have long since left before that, so they don't get it. Then it has very high deductibles, and the cost for a family is quite high per month. The individual is low, but for a family, which is what you need, it's quite high. So only 50% of all Walmart workers, and now this includes, of course, management and those who've been there for a long time. There's always a certain number of those. Only 50% of all of them take the health care benefit from Walmart directly. Now, Walmart then makes the argument that 90% of all of our workers have some sort of health benefit, either from the government or from a spouse or some other system. But, well, that's sort of saying, they say, well, we're sort of freeloading on other parts of the economy. I mean, that's what they're saying.
You make the comparison with Walmart and General Motors in its heyday. One is a retail giant. One was a big car manufacturer.
Right.
How do you make the comparison?
Right, apples and oranges, you'll say, and Walmart says that it's apples and oranges. Two things. First of all, the obvious similarity is they're both the biggest companies in the country in terms of number of employees and in terms of sales. So they're big, but that isn't the main reason I make the comparison. They were both the companies that set the standards. Famously, Charles Wilson once said, 1953 it was, actually, he said, what's good for the country is good for General Motors and vice versa. Now, everyone got very upset about that because it seemed a certain sense of hubris. But there was a certain truth to that in the sense that the General Motors then, especially in its collective bargaining relationship with the UAW, did set standards for blue-collar workers around the country. Walmart kind of says the same thing. They say, look, we are doing good things for the country. We are saving consumers a lot of money, so you should be boosting us rather than denigrating us. But it's not just that Walmart is setting a certain kind of, I think, lower standard. It's also that Walmart and General Motors are much more similar than would seem to be the case at first glance. Walmart is becoming a de facto manufacturing corporation. That is, today, sort of the most important economic function in the economy is the retail distribution function. Walmart determines the price and often the wages and the working conditions and the place in which its suppliers will manufacture everything from soap and toothpaste to lawnmowers. It's famous for that. It prides itself on that. It's one of the reasons it's so efficient. And so it's not that the retail is some very different industry than car manufacturing. In fact, both are central to the economy in their heyday, and Walmart, in fact, is becoming the de facto manufacturer.
And so you categorize Walmart as something of a manufacturer, even though a whole lot of their manufacturing goes on in China.
Well, of course, but it's like any big firm. Yes, of course. They, in fact, have either formally or informally encouraged that. The supply chain, though, from China to Bentonville and to every other Walmart store in the country is a highly integrated, highly continuous one in which Walmart knows precisely what's going on in every factory in China, where it's producing the goods that it sells. So, I mean, there's a kind of direct link, much more intimate and connected, that even General Motors in its heyday had with its suppliers or its many car dealerships. So when the president of Walmart has made the argument, said, this is a terrible comparison. General Motors is manufacturing, we're retail. Retail's always been low wage. But my point is, and that of many other historians and economists, is that today retail is the dog that wags the manufacturing tail. That's for the first time true in over 100 years, but it's unquestionably true. And I just returned from Bentonville, where you can see it physically, where all these suppliers, all these vendors are establishing offices in this once remote Arkansas town. Why? Because they have to sort of pay homage, as it were, to Walmart.
So, in a way, Walmart is setting social standards in China and places where it manufactures?
Of course, yes. It's the largest importer from China. If it were an independent country, it would be the eighth largest country. It imports already more than Great Britain and Russia. And so even in China, it is establishing the de facto standard in terms of manufacturing wages and conditions, et cetera, et cetera.
You're listening to Worldview from Chicago Public Radio. I'm Jerome McDonnell. I'm talking with Nelson Lichtenstein. He's professor of history at the University of California, Santa Barbara, and we're talking about Walmart's model for the global economy. If they're setting a social standard in China, does the Chinese government have something to say about it? Does the Chinese government say, well, we'd like you to pay X amount, or we think certain labor standards are different, or we deliver health care to our labor manufacturers? What happens there?
Well, the Chinese government, of course, is an authoritarian regime, which is now its policy is to encourage industrialization at whatever cost, and it's doing that. In fact, it now breaks strikes and arrests those who seek to raise labor standards rather than anything else. It may, in the future, play a kind of game here in which it, fearful of a really eruption in all the new industrialized districts of South China, it's possible that it's seeking to legitimize the Chinese Labor Federation, and for that reason, it insisted that Walmart recognize the Labor Federation. But really, as we speak, the policy of the Chinese government is to repress any efforts by the workers themselves to raise wages, have better conditions, et cetera, et cetera. Apparently, there was a strike just last week of 10,000 workers in a Japanese-owned factory, of which most of the product went to Walmart, and this was repressed very rapidly.
How does Walmart justify this? Do they say, well, you know, we are delivering low prices, and we are the people who are good for the economy. We're keeping inflation down. There's a lot of things, a lot of benefits that people like about us. We've got the right model.
Yeah. Well, yeah, they make the argument, and so far as it goes, it's a good argument. They save American consumers $100 billion a year in lower costs, and that may well be true. And I am in favor of lower costs. I have no objection. I'm in favor, actually, of even big box stores. I think they are an efficient way of getting product to people. But historically, going back over 100 years, in the United States, low prices and high wages have always been the key to the American century, to the miracle of the United States, to the American dream. Both have been the case. You could begin with Henry Ford, but even more important is Edward Filene of Filene's Department Store, who in the early 20th century, you know, he created the famous Filene's Basement. Well, there were low wages there, but he was also an advocate of organized labor. He helped write the Wagner Act. And the idea that the American consumer is also an American worker, they're the same, one and the same person, and that you need both high wages and low prices. And in fact, the two go together because high wages are always an incentive for the employer to create labor-saving devices, and that's one reason we have high productivity in the United States.
Well, why did Walmart throw that philosophy out the window? I mean, did Sam Walton do this on day one when he was working in Arkansas and say, you know, we're going to pay as little as humanly possible?
Well, he did, actually. And in fact, he broke the law. Walton paid below the minimum wage in an illegal fashion in this very early, early days, and he was caught doing it and had to pay fines. But here's the reason. This is one of the, to put it in the rather old-fashioned term, one of the contradictions of capitalism, as it were. Every capitalist, every employer wants his workers to get as little as possible and his rivals' workers to have as much as possible, because then they will buy his product. So it's a kind of a contradiction there. So if GM could pay less and have Ford pay more, then maybe those Ford workers could afford to buy GM cars or something of that sort. It's also a part of the origins of Walmart. It did come from rural Arkansas. And, you know, it's not that rural Arkansasians have a particular point of view. It's just that neither the New Deal nor the civil rights movement had really penetrated these rural areas of the South, and therefore the labor standards and the working condition standards and the expectation of, say, trade unionism back in the 60s and 70s when the firm really got rolling just wasn't there. And what the Walmart did was to take that standard, that rural Southern standard, and then move it into other areas of the country. Now, they're no longer a rural Southern company. They're an extremely sophisticated organization, and for which, actually, I have a great deal of respect in a certain sense. But they've just taken those standards and tried to make them national, which is why we have these big fights now in California, New York, and Chicago, where you have at least the remnants of the New Deal, the remnants of the trade union movement, are resisting their destruction.
Is this something that's an inevitable fight with Walmart? If their standards are lower than what would seem to be normal, people are going to fight them and get them to raise the standards. And this has happened in industries throughout the history of capitalism. And that's just the way it goes. Now people are fighting Walmart. They're going to get them to raise their standards.
Yeah, there is a kind of fight there, almost an inevitable fight. The outcome of it is not assured. The outcome may be that Walmart may well win, and there'll be the general erosion of wage standards in the retail and grocery industry in particular, which is highly unionized around the country. And that could easily happen, and we will end up with, in effect, the Walmart or 7-Eleven standard will be what all people in retail and grocery are paid. That's just the name of the game. So, no, it's not inevitable that the standards will go up, but the conflict is, I think, quite inevitable or seems difficult to avoid. But that's what we're facing, and that's why lots of industries, by the way, which were once high-paying, become very low-paying, and that's just the new standard. Meat processing. Chicago used to be the great center of the packing houses. These were high-wage jobs in the period after unionization. They were paid almost as much as steel workers, and now all those jobs have fled to a rural Midwest, and they employ illegal immigrants at minimum wage, almost minimum wage, and they're terrible jobs. So you can have a erosion of a job standard, which was once very good, and I think that's happening now in the unionized grocery stores all around the country under the threat of Walmart's competition.
Well, what role does government play? Sometimes there are governments, local governments, who are saying, you know what, we should change our city laws and we should have, minimums for health care and wages, and we're going to pick up the slack here. If the federal government's not going to do it, we'll do it ourselves. And are they playing some kind of role?
Well, yeah, that's what's happening in America today. In the absence of a federal government, local institutions are trying to do it. In a sense, it's a return to the era of the progressive era 100 years ago when federal laws did not exist, but you had progressive cities like Portland, Oregon, or New York City, or Chicago, for that matter. And that was sort of the seedbed of progressive era New Deal reform. So that's what's happening again today. And the various cities, including Los Angeles, for example, which passed an ordinance that said whenever a large big box store comes in, you have to do an economic impact statement. And so they're trying to provide the regulatory environment which we can sort of live with this new retail phenomena. I mean, in a sense, the regulation of capitalism, the regulation of business, has been an apple pie American tradition since at least the 1890s. But now the cities, some of the cities at least, are the carrying on that tradition. It's not as if this is some sort of new phenomena. It's very much baked into the American political economy, and it's been eroded in the last 30 years. But a city like L.A. or Chicago is carrying on that tradition.
That was Nelson Lichtenstein, a labor historian at the University of California, Santa Barbara. I spoke to him in 2005. Since then, the minimum wage was raised from $5.15 an hour to $7.25 an hour in 2009, where it's remained ever since. After the Trump administration passed its landmark tax bill last year, Walmart raised its minimum wage to $11 an hour. Adjusted for inflation, that's about the same Walmart paid its employees when this interview aired back in 2005. The Affordable Care Act means that Walmart has to insure more of its employees. But the number of part-time employees is up, too. They get limited benefits. Walmart is also negotiating directly with healthcare providers and insurers to reduce their costs. Like in 2005, Walmart is still the biggest importer from China to the U.S. Between now and the fall, we'll bring you more stories like this from our 25-year run here on Worldview. The Camino de Santiago is a 500-mile pilgrimage that people walk in Spain. It's been happening since the 9th century. Theater Y is a new play that is based on this pilgrimage, and they've pared it down to a simple 6-hour outdoor experience that ends with a meal. So we'll talk about the Camino Project, this theater piece from Theater Y, tomorrow on Worldview on our Weekend Passport segment. Hope you can join us tomorrow for Worldview. Worldview is produced by Steve Bynum and Julian Haida. Thanks to Ashish Valentine for production assistance, and thanks to Mike Gilmore for engineering today. I'm Jerome McDonnell, and you've been listening to Worldview on WBEZ.